wounded. And
hi everyone, I'm psychic medium Christopher, and I have a new show that will air the first Friday of every month from 11 to midnight Eastern Standard Time. The show is called Insight with psychic medium Christopher George. It's all about psychic readings. I welcome my listeners to call in for a free reading. Just remember, don't ask me a question that you really don't want the answer to. I'll give it to you the way the spirits give it to me. Straightforward and real. The first Friday of every month. Insight, 11 to midnight.
Welcome, everyone, to A Global Focus. With guest, Alejandro Rojas, UFO and paranormal researcher and journalist. Good evening, everyone. Trish Sheridan speaking. Welcome to the August 10th, 2012 edition of A Global Focus with featured guest Alejandro Rojas. A Global Focus is broadcast live on 107.9 FM New Orleans and the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. Guest details can be found at the show website, aglobalfocus.com. This week's program features guest Alejandro Rojas, program host, UFO and paranormal researcher, journalist, and blogger. A several-year investigator of UFO and paranormal phenomena, he has been interviewed by media organizations around the world, including the largest cable and network news agencies. Alejandro has worked with ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox News, MSNBC, the History Channel, Discovery Channel, CNN, and many more. Both Alejandro's articles and blog posts appear in the Huffington Post. For several years, Alejandro served as the Director of Public Education for the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON. He has made several appearances on Coast to Coast AM. Alejandro now runs the websites UFODailyNews.com and ThePParanormalReporter.com. Alejandro hosts UFO Think Tank Radio, an excellent program. He tweets paranormal news at ampersand or at paranormal RPPR and UFO news at UFO Daily News. Alejandro also can be followed on Facebook at facebook.com/paranormalreporter. Alejandro, welcome to the program. It's always a pleasure to speak with such a knowledgeable writer and field advocate.
Hello. It's great to talk to you again.
And, you know, Alejandro, I'm very impressed with your work. I'm a great admirer. You help to make these fields known to the public at large through your great articles and blog posts, as well as a wonderful show, a wonderful program. And your articles, blog posts, and interviews contain a great deal of interesting material. Now, Alejandro, are there any news updates you'd like to mention to our audience right off the bat?
Yeah, I think just that I am with MUFON. As a director of public education with MUFON, a lot of what I dealt with was the press. So really, we didn't have a PR position. I was kind of rolled into the public education position. But when I left, I recommended that they make those two separate positions, which they did. And now I am back as a director of public education or public research. Public relations, I'm sorry, all these different terms. So, yeah, I'm doing public relations for MUFON again, and as you talked about, you know, I'm kind of all over the social network, so really ramping up that end for MUFON. So we have at MUFON is our Twitter address, so everybody's got to go check that out, and we'll be doing lots of tweeting, and then, you know, go say hi. And then also we have a Facebook page that we have up, and so we'll be definitely getting a lot more activity going on those ends. So that's really exciting, and then I'll be doing a lot of work on the next MUFON symposium.
You know, I think those are super developments, and I think that they could, you are the most superb director of public relations they could select, for certain. Now, were you with that? Welcome. I've known to be very percipient, at least I think I'm. Very percipient. But, no, your work is outstanding. Now, Alejandro, were you at this MUFON International Symposium in Covington, Kentucky in August?
I wasn't there. You know, I just started up with this position. I did, you know, just started it just right before the conference. So I've been talking to a lot of people who were there, and, of course, paying attention to all the articles that have been coming out about it. And I've talked to Dave, the director, a few times and others. So, it was something that was trade that was a little different. So kind of fun going and doing a tour of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So, which of course is infamous in that allegedly a lot of possible material, you know, has been sent there that's been recovered that is of extraterrestrial origin. And I think different stories about Roswell craft going there. But I think what's real exciting, of course, is also Barry Goldwater, who says, you know, he spoke to his friend who was a general and had said, hey, I want to go check out the blue room where all the alien stuff is. And he was told, don't you ever talk about that again, and there's no way you're going there. So that's a really exciting story. So it sounds like they had a good time.
That's for certain. I wish so much I could have attended. I would have very much liked to have gone to that National Air Force Museum at Wright-Patterson on Sunday, but just one of those things. But, you know, I'm noticing, Alejandro, just how prompt you are to inform your of the news now on your recent, I think it's this week's, broadcast or well, very recent broadcast, you're noting that MUFON has received the Leonard Stringfield files, that great researcher, a former member of U.S. Army Intelligence. Boy, that's massive, all those files, and I guess they might contain some very intriguing material.
Right. You know, it's always scary when you tell people you got a really big announcement because people have different levels of what they feel is exciting. You know, not a lot of people agree what's exciting. But I felt really good when I talked to one of the journalists in Cincinnati, and he went to the conference and then came back and wrote the story, and he said, hey, you know, I never had a chance to ask anybody, what is this news? And, you know, this is a guy who doesn't know anything about UFOs and stuff. So I told him, well, one of the, you know, fathers of ufology, one of the guys who actually was investigating UFO crashes before Roswell was even discovered, rediscovered by Stanton Friedman. You know, this guy is a really important researcher, and his files have kind of been lost, and now MUFON has got those files. So, including all of his correspondence with a lot of people in the military or different agencies such as the FBI and CIA and things like that. So that's really exciting that these files have finally been recovered. And he said, wow, that really is big news. So it was great to hear, you know, this third party, someone who's not related to all of this stuff or isn't particularly interested even in all of this stuff, to say, to acknowledge it. Yeah, this is big news even to just kind of your regular Joe. So that was kind of a good test for me as to see, you know, what would the general public kind of think of this stuff. So that's really exciting. And Len Stringfield, you know, a lot of people have kind of forgotten who this guy is, if they ever knew, because as time goes on, that's one of the things that I think is exciting about this field, is that there has been so much, the history of UFO research is so vast, there is so much that has happened. However, this subject has never really been a focus in the main. It's kind of a sideshow thing, you know, people do get interested. And there's even, you know, the polls show that there's a good amount of people who take it seriously. However, you know, you have, when you have the documentaries, you have the Kenneth Arnold, you have the Roswell, you have the same old stories, the Phoenix Lights, and the media, if they get into the history at all, touch on a few of the big highlights, and that's about it. So much is lost, including the luminaries in this field. So it's a good thing for those of us who write about it, because even though you're writing about a story that's really old, a lot of people haven't heard about it. And, you know, a lot of people are getting interested in this field, and they're not historians, you know, and they don't know about all this unless you've read, you know, like a book like Richard Dolan's books, which are laying down the history of this field in such an excellent way, but they're big and they're daunting, and there's a lot of information in there. But so you don't know about the Lynn Stringfields. A lot of people don't know about J. Allen Hynek, who worked for the Air Force for their first investigation into or their initial real investigations into UFO, and was an independent scientist who then, you know, was a skeptic and thought everything was goofy, but then turned into someone who believed there was something to it. A lot of people have done that. Nick Pope, of course, with the Ministry of Defense was the same way. He thought this stuff was ridiculous, and then he found, wow, there's something to it. Lynn Stringfield was an Army Air Force intelligence officer in 1945. That's because this is prior to the Air Force, and they were the Army Air Force. And over Iwo Jima, he saw a UFO. He saw actually three teardrop-shaped objects that really fascinated him. He said that they had effects on the navigation systems of different craft. In fact, some people include, well, he thought he was going to have to ditch out of his craft because it started to malfunction.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what really got him interested in this field. And so he started looking into it, and he came up with a lot of really interesting stuff as far as looking into possible crashes and things like that. And nobody knows, had a lot of mystery around him because of his connections. And so that's why it's so exciting that we have these files. You know, as far as I've been in MUFON with the board and with some of the other long-timers in this field, everybody's been trying to get a hold of these files. And that's why it's really exciting that MUFON has them. Now, there's a lot of stuff there, and there's a lot to go through. And, you know, one of the things with MUFON is we're always strapped for help and resources. So, you know, it's almost like maybe MUFON takes on a little more than they can handle because everybody's spread thin. And so it's going to take some time to go through those files, and then once they're all categorized and we've gone through them, release some stories on what's in there so everybody knows and make them available to the public and digitize them and all of that good stuff. So it'll take some time, but it's really exciting that now we as a community, you know, as UFO researchers have access to this stuff. It's very exciting.
You know, it certainly is. And there was another development. I don't know shortly thereafter, I'm going to be discussing your excellent articles there at the Huffington Post. And just before we leave the subject of the MUFON International Symposium, I wanted to note that other development on the news. It was regarding Kingman, Arizona. Roger Marsh had an article entitled UFO Crash Site Detailed, Drew Revisits Kingman, Arizona Story. And apparently, the researcher, Mr. Drew, read this. Right directly from the article. More than 6 years of intensive research has uncovered two pristine UFO crash sites, in quotes, in Kingman, Arizona, that occurred over a four-day period in May 1953, according to UFO researcher Harry Drew, who made the announcement Sunday, August 5th, 2012, at the Mutual UFO Network MUFON Annual Symposium in Cincinnati, and that from Mr. Roger Marsh's article. You know, this is really exciting. I'll tell you why. Alejandro, among our researchers, we have individuals who have either experienced or reported accounts of abductions from human-type aliens. And this article discusses two different crashes at the Kingman, Arizona area. The second craft, I believe it was the second craft, at least one of the crafts, had deceased alien bodies on board, but they were of a human type. They have a human type. And that, to me, is very intriguing.
Yeah, honestly, you know, at least when I got involved, I really haven't been talking too much about the second one just because it's still pretty raw, this data, and it is anecdotal, mm-hmm. So it's difficult to speak to the veracity of the work on this one. So far, the researchers that have been able to look into it, because really, Harry Drew's been talking about this for a while now,
mm-hmm.
and have come back and...
Well, I didn't know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so in fact, with open minds, my colleague Antonio Juneas and Michael Schratt, got to go to the site, one of the sites, and do some talks because there were some locals there who organized an event where they brought some people out to the site, and they could talk, but really there was, it was kind of the middle of nowhere in the desert, so there wasn't much to find there at this point. So we'll see if there are some further studies or something else that comes of it. But right now, just like so much, mm-hmm. just like of what we have, especially, you know, with MUFON, with all of the reports, a lot of it's anecdotal. So, so of course, when you're looking for the smoking gun, you're hoping that you can find a little bit more than that. But so we'll see what happens with it, though. So
those are very good points. You know, mm-hmm. In that article, MUFON's Pennsylvania State Director John Ventry notes the evidence is circumstantial. Quote, his evidence is interesting but circumstantial, end quote. But it's intriguing because I guess apparently they found objects, or they might actually consider them artifacts of evidentiary indicators of an army presence there. Perhaps, I guess the assumption might be made that this could be during a cleanup of a retrieval, rather, and recovery of the craft, and also that one of the mountains has a huge scar on it, or one of the high points has a scar on it. But I think your points are very well taken. But it's intriguing because you have heard about Kingman over the years.
Yeah, and these. Yeah, so we'll just have to see. More work certainly has to be done. It's a lot of work, and
yes.
Unfortunately, mm-hmm. the funding isn't there at times. But hopefully, you know, if things are going well, then his information is accurate, and he'll be able to discover some more, or other researchers will help him out to do that.
You know, I agree. And pardon me. If I'm not mistaken, but this is just a kind of a quick point, I thought that several years ago at the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference, there was a discussion on Kingman, but it was preliminary, and it was people conjecturing about the crash, and I think they were trying to do layouts, but also remote viewing as well. But this particular article seemed to center on evidence, looking at maps, actually looking at the possible two crash scenes, digging through those digging for artifacts and finding possible artifacts. So it's intriguing. Now, Alejandro, I want to now, if you don't mind, go right to some of your excellent Huffington Post articles because they really floored me. They were so interesting. This household particularly admires the work of University of Arizona, and you have an article at the Huffington Post from December 28, 2011, quote, scientists suggest moon photos may reveal extraterrestrial visitation. That is super that you have two scientists from Arizona State University, and I'm quoting you now, are proposing that closely examining high-resolution photographs of the moon, retrieved Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, LRO, may reveal, subquote, incontrovertible signatures of non-human technology, end subquote. They argue that such a project is worthwhile and could be accomplished with a small budget, end quote. And you note ASU's Dr. Paul Davies and undergraduate student Robert Wagner submitted their paper, quote, searching for alien artifacts on the moon, end quote, to ACTA, or ACTA Astronautica, the official journal of the International Academy of Astronautics. That is really interesting information. Arizona State University, the other Arizona schools have just such a great reputation for wonderful scholarship and many achievements.
Especially Paul Davies, and that's what's really exciting about this one. Now, I guess it was mostly the work of one of his grad students who wrote this with the sponsorship of Paul Davies, but he certainly was pushing it and speaking to the media about it when the story broke. And it is very exciting because I've actually been one of the few people, at least in maybe the only ufologist that's got to interview Paul Davies, because he is a very important scientist in astrobiology and SETI. I got to see him with Seth Shostak, and people get really upset with SETI and with Seth Shostak because of the debates he has with Stanton Friedman and things like that. But
right.
You know what? that's what scientists do. These are scientists looking for information, and they don't agree on everything. And, you know, what was interesting here is I got to see them debate over differences about things. Paul Davies was there to help with SETI. He's part of SETI, but he doesn't feel that the rate sending or listening for signals is perhaps the best way to discover extraterrestrial life. In fact, a lot of what he was talking about when I got to interview him and he got in the news was talking about looking for a second set of life here. And what he means by that is all life we believe on Earth has a similar origin in, like, kind of a similar inception in that the DNA is similar and the components of it and things like that. And so however life was conceived on this planet, whether it be from coming from an asteroid, from another place, or for somehow some chemicals got together and just the right way and life started that way, it's all of life comes from that same inception. So, of course, you know, many people question the evolution of humankind because there does seem to be a leap. And some people believe in the ancient astronaut theory, for instance, that leap was helped by other intelligences. That's kind of a separate subject. So Paul Davies has been thinking outside of the box. In fact, he talks about looking for aliens in your nose was one of the headlines that he got, because he was talking about if we can find some microbes that show evidence of a different sort of inception of life, these would be kind of extraterrestrials that might be on this planet now that have maybe come from an asteroid or something like that. So he's a guy who thinks out of the box, but it was especially exciting when, you know, this person who's a luminary of astrobiology and space science, I mean, he's a very important person. He spoke at the recent astrobiological conference for the Royal Science Foundation. I forget the name exactly, but it's a big organization in the UK. He spoke at the Astrobiology Conference for the Vatican.
I heard about that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's a very important person. And for him to come forward and say, you know, we're getting all of these LRO images from Mars and the backside of Mars. We've got too many images to look for. They're high quality. Essentially, their plan was what we need to do is ask the public to look at these pictures with us, kind of like the SETI at Home program where people at home are using their computers to compile data for SETI. Have them look at the images, flag the areas that they think are interesting that may indicate a presence of an extraterrestrial civilization.
Yes.
Such as artifacts that were left behind by a visit. He says, you know, if there were an advanced extraterrestrial civilization that had visited the moon is dry enough and it's a perfect environment where that evidence would be saved for thousands of years, like the Apollo footsteps that are still up there that you can still see.
Right.
So maybe, you know, these three-toed footsteps or whatever, you know, or evidence of a landing or something or space junk that was left on Mars by extraterrestrials. So that's what we need to be looking for, and we have a better chance at finding, you know, evidence of extraterrestrial civilizations that way than listening for radio signals. So it's really cool that he was able to offer that up. I didn't see him really getting ridiculed for it, but he made a lot of news at that time, although I don't know if people really went into detail, so I tried to get into the detail of it. So, yeah, I think that's fascinating that Paul Davies came forward with this theory and this idea, and it just demonstrates, I mean, that's something you would hear about people talking about in our field, you know, at UFO research, things like that. And it just shows that to me, which is something I've discovered by reaching out to conventional scientists, which I try to do, that they are not so far off. You know, they are not in some other planet. We can talk to them. They will listen to us. We can work together. And if they're not going to come out and publicly endorse us, although some people do, you know, they will, they are open for discussion and they are interested in the topic, And as long as you are speaking, you know, about looking for evidence, you know, something scientifically oriented, I guess, that they will listen. And this is a perfect example of an idea that he put forth. Nobody's moved on it. And unfortunately, you know, our field gets behind a lot of different things, but nothing from conventional mainstream scientists, which would be to our benefit. So I think if people in this field really got behind Paul Davies and tried to champion this effort, it might move forward. And a lot of people say, well, you know, they're going to hide the information. They're not going to show us the real pictures, this and that. We can't give up. We can't just assume that it's going to be hidden. In a project like this, with if there was a lot of attention put towards it, that's the thing, is that there will come a time, maybe some of this stuff is being hidden. You know, Richard Hoagland did a good job to show that JPL is not sharing all of the pictures that they get. Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which are the same people who just put up this new Mars robot. So, you know, but when you put attention to it and you don't let it go and you do tackle these things in an upfront manner, using evidence and using, you know, tactics that are used in the mainstream, you can get somewhere. And there will be a time where they won't be able to. If people are out there really hiding stuff, they won't be able to. We can't give up and just assume that all of these scientists and everybody are bought out. And it's a system. It's a complicated system out there. And we're a part of it. People are a part of it. That doesn't mean that we're all definitely going to lose with that kind of attitude. And Seth Shostak wrote about this recently. He said, you know what? UFOs are worth pursuing. It is something interesting, and it is worth scientific investigation. But he ended this story with, you know, but it's a cop-out just to point fingers and say, well, we can't show any evidence because those people are hiding it, or these people are doing, those people are doing this. And he's got a great point that way. He used to be, you know, SETI, their project used to be seen as ridiculous. But they fought really hard to get to talk to people about the credibility of what they were doing. And they were able to get established, and now they're taken very seriously, along with astrobiology. And there's space in the public. I think these polls showing that at least a third of the people are into this topic. There, and many of those being scientists, there is space for us to get out there and there to be a SETI of UFOs here in America, much like they have in other countries, such as France, and Argentina, and Chile. There's space for that, and we just can't give up. Once we give up, nothing's going to happen if we stop trying. But we just can't give up. We just got to keep going for it.
Those points are really beautifully articulated. They make a great deal of sense, and kudos to you. It's a very strong argument, or arguments. Oh, also, I note in your article, Alejandro, quote, according to The Guardian, the LRO has already taken over 340,000 images and is expected to have taken 1 million by the time it is finished, end quote. So who knows, with that type of quantity and quality of images, perhaps they indeed might see an alien image if there is one there, or traces, rather.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I don't think that Paul Davies is someone who... If Paul Davies, if you showed him this, he would run with it. And he is someone who is taken very seriously. And who knows what would happen. You know, maybe he would be ridiculed if he did truly find something that he felt was extraterrestrial. However, even if that is the case, there's lots of his colleagues, because he's so well respected, who would take him seriously. And I think the media is in a spot now where they would take him seriously also, which then also bolsters this whole argument with the public. And, you know, there's a lot of power and force there. There's a lot of momentum that can be built up that way. And I think that's what's going to happen, you know. Someone may find something. He may find something like that. And then, you know, there's so much public pressure. Next robot goes to that spot.
Right.
let alone what's really exciting now, which is all of the commercial space efforts that are going on right now, where people like Elon Musk of the SpaceX,
yes,
who wants to take people to Mars, and, of course, Robert Bigelow, who now is working with SpaceX, who wants to have a hotel, essentially, a working private laboratory that people can lease in space. And these are people, private people, who, if they make discoveries, you know, won't be prone to having these discoveries being held back by any governmental force. I think people have learned, especially in the last few years, is that private industry is very powerful, and I think especially the conspiracy people out there would agree that, you know, it's this private money that has more power than anything. I mean, if you look at these super PACs, I mean, everything's bought and paid for. It's all about money. And there's no stopping these guys if they decide they want to do something. And so I think it's a really exciting time right now.
I agree. It's a wonderful transition point for the positive, if appropriately accessed and prepared for. And, you know, I'm noting here another great article of yours at the Huffington Post. Alejandro, it was posted May 22nd, entitled SpaceX Plans Flights to Private Space Station. Of course, those launches were very successful. I note here you quote SpaceX President Gwynn Shotwell, quote, SpaceX and BA, that must be Bigelow Aerospace.
Exactly.
Have a lot in common. Both companies were founded to help create a new era in space enterprise. Together we will provide unique opportunities to entities, whether nations or corporations, wishing to have crewed access to the space environment for extended periods. I'm looking forward to working with Bigelow Aerospace and engaging with international customers, end quote. And, you know, that has been very, very sick. I got here just a little NASA.gov article, or posting, rather. It was sent out by Josh Byerly from the Johnson Space Center in Houston. And just quoting from that little NASA post, congratulations to the teams at SpaceX and NASA who worked hard to make this first commercial mission to the International Space Station an overwhelming success, quoting NASA Administrator Charles Bolden. And just goes on to mention great projects and details. And you're right, it's a very these are very exciting times and developments.
Right, and, you know, to go on, I mean, these people are, if you don't know much about Bigelow, he's certainly an eccentric. He had his own UFO sighting when he was younger. He's been a UFO investigator for a long time. He started the National Institute of Discovery Sciences that did a lot of research. Some of the board members of MUFON were part of that organization. I know John Alexander's worked with him. A lot of other scientists work on the mysterious ranch, the Skinwalker Ranch in Utah.
Right.
It's turned into a book by George Knapp. And, you know, they have reports. All the investigations they do, they write up in reports and they make them public. So you can read about everything they've done. The NID stuff is hard to find now because they dissolved that organization. And as time goes on, those files get harder to find. I've got them all somewhere, and I know a lot of people who do have them. But they've done a lot of research, and he's someone who certainly is interested in this topic. And he's the one who, with his Bigelow Aerospace, they have purchased and of course, Bigelow Aerospace also, you know, was funding MUFON for a period of time for some research. And there were some interesting cases that I wrote about in Open Minds and about their really good cases that they were able to look into. But this Elon Musk is the CEO of SpaceX, and he's certainly eccentric himself. In fact, talking about quotes, here's one quote, and his drive and why he does what he does. He says, I think it's important that humanity become a multi-planet species. I think most people would agree that a future where we are a space-faring civilization is inspiring and exciting compared with one where we are forever confined to Earth until some eventual extinction event. That's really why I started SpaceX. So, I mean, he's talking about sci-fi, but we're almost there, you know. He's a younger guy, and he's thinking we need to become a space-faring civilization. So it's really exciting stuff.
Very reasonable. Mm-hmm.
You know, what's it always reminds me of also, and is this lady who said, you know, she believed she was an abductee, and she remembers being aboard a large craft, and there are lots of different types of beings. And she was being shown around, and she was shown, you know, to meet these weird beings, and they said, what's that? And, you know, her host said, this is from Earth, and they were like, wow, interesting. And she asked the abductee, where are you from? And they said, here. And she's like, what do you mean? And they said, we live on this ship. This is our home. We don't have a home planet. And she said, well, that's pretty weird. And they said, and all of this was, you know, no words being used. It was all telepathic. And they said, well, we think it's weird that you live on a planet because there's, you know, that a planet can get hit by an asteroid. There's weather. It's very dangerous to live on a planet, whereas it's very safe to be living on this craft. So it was a very interesting thought.
Yes.
Which makes a lot of sense. And if you have the technology, you know, often we think of spaceship like the movie Aliens or Battlestar Galactica, these ugly, hulking things. But if you look at, there are some Japanese cartoons, anime, if you're into that stuff. And I like some of those because it's so out-of-the-box thinking. And they have these huge space that are very pleasant, where the inside is just like on Earth because they're so humongous and they've got soil and trees and everything and artificial gravities that it is just this huge Earth-like pleasant environment. So who's to say that's not possible at some point in the future? So it's just fascinating to see the future opening up before us.
Indeed, and those are very thought-provoking concepts. Excellent,
yeah.
Excellent subjects there for thought. And, you know, Alejandro, as well, your program, UFO Think Tank, continues to set a high standard for excellence in in-depth discussion on latest field developments. Now, Alejandro, I really got a kick out of the fact that your forum regarding the Chase Brandon announcement with yourself, Lee Spiegel, Stanton Friedman, and Grant Cameron really was the definitive, one of the definitive opening forums for this discussion on the new development. Chase Brandon asserting that he had come across mm-hmm. that box at CIA headquarters of materials that might that would indicate the credibility of the Roswell crash.
Yeah, you know, it was terribly interesting news, of course, with this Chase Brandon, and he first went coast to coast, and
right.
He was a CIA guy, and he said, mm-hmm. you know, I saw a box that Roswell was written on it, and I looked into it, and it confirmed my suspicion that it really was an extraterrestrial craft that mm-hmm. crashed in Roswell, and there were alien bodies. So, of course, this is pretty bombshell, using the term
right.
in an accurate way. This is definitely bombshell. So it was interesting, the stories, because I am really good friends with Lee Spiegel now, who wrote the story for the Huffington Post that really made it explode. And that's what's great about his stories now, is lots of his stories are exploding across all of the mainstream media, because Huffington Post is big. I don't know if people realize this, but it's the sixth largest online news source. and I got to look up, I'll look up the list, but it's like, you know, there's CNN, Washington Post, New York Times, and, you know, then I think Google News, and Huffington Post is up there and above Yahoo and all of these MSNBC. I mean, number six, so it's huge. And it's incredible that they allow Lee Spiegel to focus on mostly UFO stories in this major mainstream online magazine or news format. So he's pretty much the lone international, you know, UFO journalist out there in a major venue like this. So when he wrote about the Chase story, it was really big. What was frustrating for him and for me is, of course, everybody's talking about it then. And I'm seeing my colleagues write about it, my friends and everything. And nobody's talking to Lee. Lee's like, nobody's calling me. They're making all of these assumptions.
Yes.
They're not talking to Chase because Chase was not talking to anyone.
And he interviewed Chase. Did he interview Chase personally? Was it in New York City? I'm not sure.
He interviewed. Mm-hmm. You're correct. He interviewed Chase personally, so he got to do a lot of follow-up questions. He got to meet him, also go meet him because he was in New York for a book signing at a big convention there. And so, yeah, he got to meet and talk to Chase a few times. He's pretty much the Chase connection at this point, although Chase went on to Coast to Coast again after Lee's story got really big. So they definitely must have a good relationship with him also. But nobody was really talking to Lee, so I thought, well, we got to get Lee. We got to get, of course, the guy who brought Roswell to the public, Stanton Friedman, the guy who discovered Roswell, and of course is a legendary researcher, at least in my mind, and, you know, Lee really respects him also. I mean, we wouldn't know about Roswell if it wasn't for Stanton Friedman. So we got to talk to him, and mainly because, you know, this is what often happens, is that sometimes people will come forth with a story, but the facts just don't jive, they don't fit. And so to ask Stanton along those lines. Plus, I had Grant Cameron on because Grant Cameron was with a group of friends who had written the CIA and who had gotten a response. And so we wanted to know, I didn't really know what else they had asked of the CIA because the CIA ignored all of their questions and just kind of told them what they wanted, which was to say that we're not sure what this box is he's talking about. We went to look for it. And that's essentially all they said. And Grant Cameron, of course, is a phenomenal researcher. This guy does so much in-depth research. And he's got a website where he posts a lot of it. And I have read his site from beginning to end. And that is volumes and volumes and volumes of stuff. And that's only about a quarter of his research, because the rest is in his head.
Yes.
I mean, this guy is amazing.
Cool. Mm-hmm.
So I definitely wanted to have him on because he was suspicious that the CIA was behind this, which, of course, to me at the time was a little far-fetched, but, you know, he's a great friend, and I wanted to hear his argument, you know, and have him talk with the rest of the group to see what we think. And so, yeah, I thought it was the perfect group to have together. So we talked about this. We had it from the source, from Lee, which I think was really important because a lot of people are making assumptions and they didn't know all the facts. And you have to know all the facts to be able to speak to this or that, because if you make an assumption that is wrong, then you're building your case off of bad data. And you're wasting your time. And, you know, I don't want my buddies wasting their time because they're so super intelligent people. Pull the base of the facts together first and then make our speculation off of that. And just like science, see if we can support some of that speculation. So what was interesting, what did come of that, what he had said was consistent with what he knew. A lot of people felt that it was far-fetched that there would be some box labeled Roswell. One reason was because the crash wasn't necessarily in Roswell, so why would they call it Roswell? Also, when the crash happened, you know, it was the Army that had it. It was at, it was in Corona, where it was first kind of announced, and where Jesse Marcel went, or not Jesse Marcel, but the Mac Brazel. So there were all of these kind of questions, so which are still questions, quite frankly, and nobody knows for sure, except for Chase Brandon, which is kind of Lee's point, is that unfortunately, you know, I don't think the CIA is going to tell us anything. The only one that really knows is Chase Brandon. But Grant did make a compelling argument that this is consistent with a lot of incidents in the past where officials, largely in the past it's been Air Force intelligence, comes forward and says they've got a scrap of evidence and it doesn't pan out or it's not confirmable, but it's something that is generated from official channels, and Chase Brandon being an official CIA representative. Another thing that was interesting is the guy I interviewed the next week is Robbie Graham, and he is a doctoral. He is a doctoral student in film, and he has a website called Silver Screen Saucers. And this website, he just watches movies, and, you know, when they do movies, which, of course, they do like crazy these days, about UFOs and aliens, he puts those on site and he talks about them, and then, you know, we'll look at what parts are similar to the mythos behind UFO research and stuff like this. And I've known about Chase Brandon for a long time because Chase Brandon was the entertainment liaison for the CIA. So Chase Brandon has been working with directors in Hollywood for a long time. So that's why Graham has, why Robbie had known about him, because, you know, he's known about his work, working on different movies as an advisor and stuff like that. And, you know, one really great point came from that. When we wrote his story, all the other major media picked it up. Everybody was really excited about it. It went all over the place. Lee got 2 million hits or something like that, just like astronomical. So a lot of attention being paid to the story. And when he talked to Chase, Chase seemed a little hesitant. He's like, wow, you know, I didn't know this thing was going to get so big. I didn't mean for it to get so big. And he was kind of playing innocent. And Robbie Graham's argument was, there's no way he wouldn't have known that this would be a big deal, because that was his job for many years, to say, hey, you guys, you know, you're kind of putting the CIA in this light, really accurate, you should do it this way. I mean, he was a PR guy for the CIA.
Yes.
So being a PR guy, it was his job to scrub that stuff to make sure that it was, you know, spun correctly. And so he would be very aware of the spin that he was putting on this story, and that the buzz it would most likely create. And so that's another interesting aspect of the whole thing, is that, you know, what's going on here? Why did he say it? Was it okay that he said it? Did everybody know in the CIA, or at least his superiors, know that he was going to say it? Some people make an argument that Obama knew that he was going to say it. I don't know about that. I don't think I'd go that far. But because, of course, these organizations are also very independent. You know, I mean, they're going to be around when Obama's gone and the next president and the next president. They're there for a long time. So a lot of questions come to light, but at least it is a very, it's something that adds to this huge stack when it comes to Roswell. Especially Roswell, and people say, oh, it's a lot of talk. Every July comes around, and, you know, we just went through July, so you have to read these frustrating stories from journalists who don't do much research about Roswell, and they're asking, why does this myth keep persisting? You know, it's ridiculous. Of course, it was nothing extraterrestrial. You know, people just like to have their parades and sell books, and that's the only reason this story could be going on, when they don't look at the evidence. And the evidence is, at least even though a lot of it is anecdotal. There's no doubt about that. But the people you have...
The witnesses, yes.
Witnesses are extraordinary. Beginning with the Air Force intelligence officer who collected the material to begin with, Jesse Marcel, saying, you know, this was real alien material. His son, who... Jesse Marcel Jr., who's a doctor with the Army, you know, very credible person, who says, yeah, I touched it. My dad showed it to me. It was not of this earth. Then going on from a lot of military witnesses, some of them on their deathbed, who say, you know, before I die, I want to know that that really happened. There were aliens there. I mean, the list of witnesses is just so huge. And then when you're putting on top of this more and more people, and now we have, you know, a big one to add to the stack, Chase Brandon, a guy who worked for the CIA, said he saw proof in the CIA's archives that Roswell was an extraterrestrial craft and there were bodies. Another very credible source added to the pile. So even if there is some sort of ulterior motive behind the statements, he's someone to add to the list that makes it so you can't just disregard, you know, this story so quickly.
You know, you've made a series of excellent points about these matters, Alejandro. We're at about 10 seconds going to just a break for about, is it 10 minutes, Joe? I'll just quickly watch for our wonderful network owner's answer. And, you know, I think the world right now is fascinated by the reports of what Mr. Brandon did find at the CIA's historical intelligence collection. And I'd love to also discuss with you your interview with Robbie Graham. Interesting that people from the UK are so closely monitoring our Hollywood and of course, our histories here of UFO sightings, crashes, and interaction. And also, when we get back, I want to discuss with you that great coverage you've been doing of Huffington Post as well, and also Lee Spiegel on that, I believe it's Lieutenant Colonel French Manor, Lieutenant Colonel French Manor on Roswell, his assertions now about that particular crash. So we'll be back in about 10 seconds, and boy, I'm really enjoying myself. Lots of fascinating information. Great points there, Alejandro. So we'll be back, what, in about 8, 10? Okay, let's make it 8 minutes. And see you then back at the start of the second segment.
Great, thanks.
Thanks, Alejandro. UFO. Welcome back, everyone, to A Global Focus with guest Alejandro Rojas, UFO and paranormal researcher and journalist. Now with Alejandro Rojas, and at this point in the program, I just wish to briefly mention to our listeners the other excellent programs on the UPRN network. These include UFO Undercover, Wednesday evenings from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern with Joe Montaldo. Second Sight NYC on Thursday evenings with co-host Stephanie Benetti and psychic medium Chris George. On the first Friday of each month, psychic medium Chris George's excellent call-in show, Insight. Now, of course, Karen Dolan appears every Friday just before this program with her excellent show, Through the Keyhole, with host Karen Dolan. Also, the new program, News on the Flip Side, on Saturday, just made a really very dynamic, very successful debut last Saturday. And also, of course, on Saturdays, we have Voice of the People with Greg Miller and Jeffrey Pritchett's Church of Mavis. And on Mondays, of course, we've got that Mind Cemetery with wife Chip and Nicole, husband-wife Chip and Nicole. And on Tuesdays, Gia Scott's Dawn of Shades. A wonderful lineup. Take time to hear the programs. You'll find them very informative, very engaging. Okay. Okay, and back to wonderful guest Alejandro Rojas. His material indeed is fascinating. Great field spokesperson, writer, researcher, host. And of course his program is UFO Think Tank. Don't miss it. It's really a wonderful experience each week. Also, Alejandro runs websites, theparanormalreporter.com and ufodailynews.com. He also can be reached on Twitter at ParanormalRPTR and also at UFO Daily News on Twitter. And Alejandro, for UFO Think Tank, they just Google that, correct? And they come right to that great page for your program.
Right, or you can go to ufodailynews.com and there's a link right up top. So either way, but if you Google it, it'll come up right up on top.
And also, please inform our listeners just when they should tune in for the show.
Anytime, really. I have the show, I air it at 7 p.m. Arizona time, which right now is Pacific, through Blog Talk Radio. However, I do have a few listeners and a few people. There's a chat room. You can chat through there. But really, most of my listeners are podcasters who listen at any time. So that's a great thing about podcasts right now. You know, people can just listen whenever they want.
Excellent. And, you know, your websites contain a great deal of the latest and very thought-provoking material. And I appreciate your shows always focusing on the latest developments and try to produce both material, concepts, and evidentiary points that would really speak both to the researchers, experiencers, and the public at large. It's a great show. Now, quickly back, Alejandro, to Roswell. Your show had mentioned that, I believe, this week as well, or just very recently anyway. It was on developments discussed in the Huffington Post. And I believe that this, let me see, was this the Elise Spiegel article? Because next we'll be discussing another one of your fine articles at the Huffington Post. Now, this one concern the fact it's entitled Roswell UFO Crash. There were two crashes, not one, says ex-Air Force official. You were discussing this on your program and that article. There were actually two crashes at Roswell, which most people don't know, French told HuffPost. The first one was shot down by an experimental U.S. airplane that was flying out of White Sands, NM, New Mexico, and it shot what was effectively an electronic pulse-type weapon that disabled and took away all the controls of the UFO, and that's why it crashed, end quote. And then in the article, too, they do reference that John Alexander, another fine military person, Army colonel, he was the pioneer there, just as an aside, in the a leading advocate of the development of non-lethal weapons. He's a member as well of the Hall of Fame of the National Airplane, or is it Aeronautic Museum in Washington? I think it's the Air
I think you're right. I think it's a National Aeronautic Museum. I can't remember
Thank
the exact
you.
Title either. But
National
it's
Aeronautic. Thank you so much on that. But, you know, he differs with that. He is saying, quote, in the 1980s, I was the guy developing all the pulse power weapon systems. We couldn't have done it then, end quote. What do you think about this? It's certainly a very interesting point on Roswell. It's great to see that particular crash discussed for you.
Yes, I've talked about it a couple weeks because the first story that came out was through Open Minds and through Antonio Huneas. So, I think the day after he posted, or very soon after he posted it, I was able to talk to him about the story. They actually posted an interview where you can see him live, and Lee did embed that video in his story. So Antonio talked to him first, and I think Antonio has the best quote that Lee has in his story, which was that he has some reservations about the claims that he makes. Because of his age, his memory isn't as good as it used to be. And this is a big one. It's clear to me that he's fairly well-read on subjects of UFOs, or he might have heard stories or talked to people. So I'm trying to separate exactly what he lived and saw directly from what he heard and read. And Lee's kind of said a similar type of thing, that when you listen to the interview and when you look at the quotes, he's saying, this happened, this happened, that happened, this happened. He says, I used to be a debunker, and I was told debunked UFO stories for the Air Force. So that's great. That's one thing that we know he did. We do know he really was an Air Force lieutenant colonel, that he did a lot of flying. There's a picture from him, you know, that Lee posted, and that also Open Mind Juice in their video. So we know that this guy really was with the Air Force, and he says he debunked UFO sightings. From that, we don't know what is hearsay and what is not. He says, you know, when he's pressed on it, he says that he heard a lot of this from his friends. And then other things that he mentions, he says he has read in, like, UFO books and stuff. So, and he just really goes on these long tangents of this, this, that, and that. And he's an older gentleman, so it's hard to pin him down, and people haven't really, like Antonio said, he's still trying to pin down, okay, what do you know as firsthand? And the cool part is what he says he does know as firsthand knowledge is that he was told to debunk UFO stories. And that even though these cases, they believe, were real. So that's really interesting. As far as knowing for sure that there were two craft or that one was downed by a pulse, magnetic pulse, from what I understand from asking Lee and Antonio, that was kind of stuff that he had heard. And then, of course, you have Alexander saying there's no way. Is there a chance that there was technology Alexander didn't know about? Possible. That's a possibility also, so it's difficult to say. One of the other things that was a little bit concerning is when Antonio asked him about Colonel Corso. And, of course, Colonel Corso worked for the research and development of foreign materials, which means that,
yes.
You know, when typically foreign, meaning other countries, was retrieved, they would examine it and try to back engineer this stuff. And that when he was working at the Pentagon, he was given some material allegedly from Roswell that the Army had received, and these materials he then different companies to develop into technologies. That's what he did years after the Roswell incident. And Dick French says, oh yeah, I knew Colonel Corso and all those alien bodies and all the, you know, the UFO he had, they took it away from him and sent it to Wright Patterson. Well, that's not consistent with what Colonel Corso says. Did he mix up between Jesse Marcel? How did he know Colonel Corso? You know, in what capacity? So, and I guess, so there's been some kind of mix-ups in all of this stuff. To try to pin down what he really knew. And then another quote, which is kind of interesting, is, you know, Lee said, well, you know, you probably know about Project Blue Book. And he said, oh, yeah, I was one of the authors of Blue Book. Well, Blue right. Book was a project name. It wasn't, you know, a right. book like the Blue Book we use for looking up prices for on cars and things. But so that's another kind of inconsistency in that. Although he could have written reports that went into Blue Book, and maybe that's what he meant. There's just a lot that's not that he says there were two crashes. You know, some people agree with that, and I think even that's Stanton Friedman's current hypothesis, or that's what he believes, that there were probably two crashes. So a lot of researchers do believe that. Some believe there are three. So there are lots of different versions of what might have happened in Roswell, and people are trying to figure out exactly what did happen. But it has made a lot of news, and it's another at least Air Force gentleman who's saying, you know, that he does know the Air Force did investigate UFOs, and he was part of that. And he really was a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force.
Well, you know, again, thanks for those great points there. They helped me really further understand this article and its implications. And, you know, Alejandro, I'd also like to note at this point the excellent work you've done moderating conferences, including the 2011 and 2012 International UFO Congresses near Scottsdale, Arizona at the Fort McDowell Resort. You're a wonderful conference spokesperson and a great point of contact for speakers and also members like me. And, you know, Alejandro, here, too, I'd like to note, to me, the importance of Latin American sightings in ufology and the ET field, I was floored by the presentations, both in English and Spanish, of that Chilean general, Ricardo Bermudez, who spoke at last February's Open Mind Conference at that international UFO conference in, well, they say Scottsdale, but it, Fort McDowell, actually, that resort casino.
Right. That was, I think that's it really important. And then I did an interview with him and, well, not him, with Leslie Kane and Jose, and who was, is their kind of their spokesman.
Mm-hmm.
And they've made Leslie Kane actually their spokesperson in the United States.
Excellent.
So she's officially their spokesperson for the Chilean group that looks into UFOs. And this is a group that is part of their version of the FAA. So interesting enough, the group that they have that's investigating UFOs is called CEFAA, C-E-F-A-A, and they pronounce both A's, so it's A-A, which is kind of fun to say.
Yes.
But, so their military is really, and you know, there's the general who is heading up the group who came to speak at the UFO Congress. They're heading up this effort to look into and take a serious look at this phenomena. Everybody, you know, from their version of FAA and the military funnels their sightings through them, and they've got a lot of really interesting cases, all of which they post up on their website, and you can go, well, if you know Spanish, you can read them, or at least you can see the videos.
That's
so there's a lot of really interesting things going on out there. Argentina has a group from their Air Force, and this group is investigating UFOs, and they are partnering up with the civilian UFO organizations, just like they're doing in Chile. And I think that's one of the really important things that's happening out there, is that they have a model.
Yes.
That works, where there is a committee of their Air Force that also works with their civilian organization, whatever large one there is out there, and they work together so that they could be sure that there's transparency in what they're doing.
Transparency and consistency. That sounds like wonderful objectives to me.
Right, and the one of the important things behind that is that, like Jose said, you know, who's a representative for CEFAA,
yes,
you know, he said that this isn't ours. A lot of these sightings come from the public. This isn't our information, meaning this isn't the government's information. So we can't keep this information to ourselves. You know, we have to share it with the public and work with the public on it because they're an integral part of this whole process. And so that was really cool to hear him say that. And I think they've made great strides in setting up perfect examples of something that we could do out here. And that's the thing is that, you know, I just think that we as a public and individuals have a lot more power if we assert it. And we just got to be smart. There's always ways to do things. You know, people are afraid of getting strong-armed. But in the situation, and then once you're in the situation, I think of working with an organization, such as maybe a committee from the Air Force, once you're faced with maybe some of this strong arm situation, you can still think of ways to release information and get it out there. I think that we just have to finesse the system, which is what it's all about, and you can't be afraid to tackle these things and give it a shot and hope that you're able to, you know, fall backwards into something or outsmart somebody, which I think is always possible.
Beautifully said. You're such a strong field advocate. And, you know, I think an example, too, of a person who knows how to research as well the sources and get that testimony, like yourself, is Leslie Kane, and I note from your material, of course, her excellent book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record, did garner her interviews, I believe, on all the major stations, like yourself, CNN, MSNBC, Fulbert Report, Colbert Report, pardon me, NPR, USA Today, and just like yourself, you're becoming spokespeople of a field and subject matters, field and subject matters that really are of integral importance to researchers and the public at large.
I think especially Leslie Kane, because she continues to get, I think she just recently spoke with PBS. She continues to get these audiences and to speak with different researchers, and it's really exciting. I mean, it's not often, but you know, I guess recently she went to a book signing of Michio Kaku's in New York, and there were a lot of people there. And he took a moment to say, you know, Leslie Kane is here, and I want to acknowledge her work, and she does great work. And Michio Kaku right now may be the most famous physicist out there, most famous theoretical physicist, besides maybe Stephen Hawking. So that's a big deal, you know, that people like this are noticing her work. She receives, you know, notes and things from different scientists. Of course, this organization, Jason Sepa'a, when she went out to Chile, you know, they treated her with a lot of respect, like she was a foreign dignitary. She said she felt like a foreign dignitary. They took her around, you know, and she's being escorted by generals and things like this. So she is really, you know, the level, and she's taken serious. I haven't seen anybody really make fun of her. The first UFO Congress that we brought to Phoenix, she we were able to get her an interview on MSNBC. And, you know, they were, just like always, they treated her very well because she is very credible and careful in what she says to make sure that what she's saying is very, comes across as very credible and mainstream friendly.
Yes.
And that you do have to be careful in what you say and make sure you are referencing, just like you have to do in a college paper or something, your sources, and when your sources are generals and FAA officials and colonels people in charge of large organizations, governmental organizations, whether they be abroad or here, then, you know, they're going to have time poking holes at what you're saying.
Very much so. Very, very much so. Again, very. Your argument's a very strong one. I'm noticing here as well the fact that you do bring to your listening audience information on the tremendous amount of sightings occurring at this time. Recently you noted the very large number of Canadian sightings, also the fact that the MUFON database is, of course, receiving information on these and other sightings. And I think what's intriguing as well is the activity here around the West. I know at a MUFON Greeley meeting, Clifford Clift, when asked a question about just where certain hotspots might be in Colorado, he referenced the Fort Collins area. Now here I note Roger Marsh has an article out on a huge triangle seen, I have to get my page here, I believe it's over Surprise, Mexico. And I notice that at the same time, other UFO organizations are noting within the past week sightings over Scottsdale, Fountain Hills, and in July, Mesa, and also, I believe, Kingman. So a great deal of activity over the Arizona area, too.
Right. Yeah, really, and you know what? I think that, and I think we need to do a lot more of this with MUFON, is I haven't seen anybody else take the data and put it into Excel and do some actually number crunching, and I try to do that periodically, and what I get has been always really interesting. And for the top states when it comes to UFO sightings, I think the last time I crunched the numbers was at the end of 2011. And I also put this up on the Huffington Post and in Open Minds. And these were MUFON numbers, but MUFON receives the most sightings from any organization. They receive I think last month, over 600 sightings.
Yes.
So a lot of sightings. And yes, the western states come up. Now, one of the ways that I do it, I put, for instance, this last time, I have the top 10 states per the numbers. And they often very much correlate with the higher populations. So then I also figure it as to per population. And some of those are like, you know, or at least one of them was like 10 sightings in one state, but there's so few people in the state that it was statistically it didn't work. And so, and with statistics, you always need, your rule of thumb is to have 30. If you have 30 or more, then it's more statistically accurate. So I took out the 30 and less. And what I came up with was really interesting, and Arizona and Colorado are at the top, Arizona being number one, and with like 2.7 sightings per person. So Arizona does have a lot of sightings, and I've tried to do some investigation out here because I am a field investigator for MUFON, and it's hard to keep up because there are a lot of sightings out here. And same with Colorado. Number three, interesting enough, was Oregon, and we get a lot of people. In fact, we used to get a few people with open minds who would say, oh, yeah, we see them so much out here, it's no big deal. In Oregon. So it seems they have a lot of sightings out there. Then came Indiana, Missouri, Kentucky, Nevada was on the list, Kansas, Michigan, and Connecticut. And the Kansas-Michigan area has been having a lot of sightings, especially Kansas has been, in the last couple of years, had a lot of sightings, and that's why they're up there. So, but a lot of western states, I think partially, you know, you wonder why, and I used to do a lot of analysis in Colorado, because I used to live out there and be an investigator out there.
Right.
And, in fact, you came to one of my conferences that I
Yes, indeed. Loved it very much. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming. But it's hard to say. Of course, there are a lot of Colorado, Arizona, and Nevada are military testing grounds. It does happen a lot out here. In fact, very near where I live is the Goldwater Range. And people used to say, you know, in fact, the later, 10 p.m. sighting on the Phoenix Lights, the military said that was dropping flares. And I thought, how the heck do you see flares from Phoenix all the way to Goldwater testing range, because it's at least the very tip of the northern tip is about 50 miles away from Phoenix. Well, it didn't take long till I found out how. Those things, the flare technology, I don't know what's up with it, but it is amazing. Those things are incredibly bright. You don't see any smoke. They float up in the air for a very long time, and they don't look like they're moving. And I videotaped them because they, you know, they'll do exercises out over the Goldwater Range a lot. In fact, they're bringing the new, is it the F-22 that or F-35, the new jets, they're going to start testing them out here. So now they're going to be flying over my house, but it'd be cool to see them, but I'm sure they're going to be loud. But anyway, the flares did floor me. I took videos of the flares. I took pictures of the flares. And definitely a lot of what people are seeing out here are those flares. But of course, there's also much more mysterious sightings. I had an investigation I did in Fountain Hills, which you had mentioned, which is where the UFO Congress is.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really weird, you know. It was this couple. The wife goes out and smokes on a regular basis, you know, when she gets home from work, and she did so in this case. And she saw something weird, called her husband out there. They took a couple pictures, and you couldn't really tell what this is because they were kind of fuzzy, but it certainly didn't look like a plane. It was some anomalous lights in the sky, but what they described was certainly not like a plane or anything, and they said they, you know, smokers are there outside all the time watching the sky, smoking, especially if their spouse doesn't smoke because they're all by themselves out on the patio watching the sky and just hanging out. So she does this all the time. They see planes and the helicopters all the time, but this was something that they hadn't seen before. What was it? I've had a couple of just very interesting sightings from people out here, and so there are a good amount of unknowns also. And that's kind of interesting because typically when I run the numbers with the UFO or with the MUFON database, I usually lately have come up with like 20% are marked as on it. And after they've been investigated by an investigator. So, and unknown is the best we can get with our MUFON investigations because it just means that, you know, a man-made or mundane object has been ruled out. Of course, that doesn't mean it's extraterrestrial. It means that we're not sure what it was, or we couldn't say for sure it was man-made. But it does mean that there are a lot of things that it couldn't be figured out. And that number's, you know, fairly high. It's 20% out of all those sightings. That's if it's, you know, in America with 500 sightings a month, that means that... something like 100 sightings are unknowns. And let's say even 10% of those are something that are truly anomalous. Then that's 10 a month. And that's quite a bit, especially when you consider that people even have to find MUFON their website to report it. And people don't know MUFON even exists. So it's incredible that they're able to... These are people who are motivated enough to go online and look for somebody that they can report these to.
Strong points there, Alexandro. And, you know, I wanted to note as well, you gave an excellent interview with Margie Kay on the sightings. Is that over Kansas City?
Yes.
Wow, that was a really interesting interview there, Alejandro. And also, just for our listeners, when I was referencing that article about some major Arizona sightings, it's actually, I believe, by Roger Marsh. You can view it at examiner.com, entitled Large Triangle Objects Reported Over Arizona and California. And he's referencing a huge triangle, quote, a huge triangle object moving across a dark sky on August 7, 2012, according to testimony from the Mutual UFO Network. And one of the witnesses is from Surprise, Arizona. Very intriguing. Now, if we could go off to a bit of a tangent here, Alejandro, as was slightly, just a bit touched upon in the first segment, you gave a great July 23rd interview with Robbie Graham on Hollywood and UF, and also on most likely the Chase Brandon matter as well, and the fact that the UK is really analyzing, keeping a strong watch on reports of UFOs and just the way they're treated in our media and, of course, Hollywood. Also, Alejandro, other Hollywood actors and figures very closely follow your research. Now, is that one of those individuals, Thomas Jane, and on the topic of Hollywood coverage of the UFO and ET and related subjects, do you see this trend as continuing to increase?
I think so. You know, yeah, I have luckily been able to speak with Thomas Jane. I met him in at a MUFON conference last year, and his buddy was a fan of my radio show, so I was very flattered, and so I've kept up with Thomas Jane a bit, and he was a guy in the HBO series Hung, which is really popular lately, and he was the Executioner. Is that the name of the superhero, the movie he did? He's in a lot of stuff. He's in Deep Blue and all kinds of stuff. But yeah, he's really into this topic. Really neat guy. And there are a lot of other celebrities that are really into this topic. Katy Perry, Sigourney Weaver, and, you know, recently, like, Christie Brinkley has talked about her sightings. One of the thrills of my life was I was able to get an interview with Dan Aykroyd to talk about UFOs for just a couple short minutes. Yeah, there are a lot more, and it does seem like they're feeling more comfortable. As more and more of them come out, they seem to feel more and more comfortable to speak about this topic themselves. And that's exciting that I think we're on the cusp of conquering the giggle factor.
Excellent. What a great development.
And that's the important part, is that now the celebrities don't seem to... Of course, celebrities have always not shied away necessarily from being eccentric. But they still shied away often from this topic. But they seem to be doing so less and less. Really, we've only had a couple negative comments come from celebrities lately. George Clooney kind of made fun of the topic, saying, if there's all these cell phones out there where they can take pictures, why haven't we gotten a good picture from a cell phone? But, of course, yet try to take a picture of playing with your cell phone, and let's see how that turns out. But someone else, it was Billy Ray Cyrus, was going to have a TV show with his son where they were going to debunk a lot of paranormal stuff, including UFOs. But that show didn't happen. And then last year, he tweeted this picture and said, I finally saw my first UFO sighting. I'm guessing he was being sarcastic and silly, but I don't know for sure. But yeah, he did tweet something about that. Other people have tweeted, though. Demi Lovato tweeted that she had seen a UFO sighting. Did anybody see this over L.A.? What the hell is this? And then some paparazzi caught up with her and said, what's up with that video or that tweet? And she said, yeah, me and my friend just saw something weird. I don't know what it was. So, you know, and she didn't really shy away from it. But one of my favorites was Sammy Hagar has talked about how he believes he was abducted and has had communications with extraterrestrials, and that's inspired his creativity and his work. In fact, his guitar is like says Roswell on it and has a little alien on it, one of his guitars that he uses a lot. And one of my favorite comments, and I think she said this to Japanese journalist, was Sigourney Weaver when with the movie Paul about the alien who broke out of Area 51. Pretty funny movie, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
But they ask her, well, do you believe in this stuff? And she says, yeah, I think that the government is hiding stuff, that they're not telling us, that they know that UFOs are here and there's a big conspiracy. And, I mean, she was getting all into it. So that was really cool. And, you know, she didn't care to just say, hey. And then what's really exciting lately, and it's the Ridley Scott movie, Prometheus. I'm a huge fan of the Alien movies. The third one was just okay, but I even like the fourth. I mean, I love these. And Ridley Scott's great. And he said, you know, he believes in the ancient astronaut theory and some of the writing of, like, Von Daniken, and that he thinks that we probably... earlier I was talking about, you know, that gap where people don't know exactly how humans develop because we seem to take a leap from, you know, the primates and things like that. And and he says, I believe we were helped along. And that's what this movie is about. You know, you have these guys who come here and see life. And he thinks that that's a possibility, and that's what this movie was about. And that's what's so exciting. It added to the excitement of watching the movie. I went and saw it in a 3D IMAX. And it feels like you're landing on this planet, and especially looking at, you know, NASA and the rover landing and everything, when you're watching this movie, it feels like you're really landing on this planet near these anomalous-looking ziggurat-type mountains that look to be artificial, and of course they turn out to be, and it just really, the imagination is going and the possibilities. And it's just so, so exciting because there's so much discovery still to be made. I interviewed this skeptical physicist a couple of weeks ago. And, of course, he doesn't believe in UFOs and stuff, but talking about the possibilities and physics and naturals and life and where it comes from. And he makes a really great point, though. And that's why he's not afraid to at least speculate along with me, because his point is we don't know where life came from. We really don't know. So when scientists are talking about the genesis of life on Earth, they're just purely speculating because we have absolutely no clue if it came from an asteroid. He argues we don't know. They can't make fun of the religions because they don't know if some omnipotent Forrest didn't put it here. Or, like Prometheus, we don't know that some other advanced civilization didn't bring it here. We just don't know.
Those are wonderful thoughts and beautifully expressed. You know, your the material there on Ridley Scott, too, is referenced in one of your articles at the Huffington Post. Mm-hmm. Beautifully said. I, too, saw Prometheus, and the images were definitely remarkable. Very memorable, actually. Also, just as we come to the close of the program, I want to note, Alejandro, again, how much UFO think tank as well. I was listening to one of your interviews, rather a vintage interview by, is it Don Daniels, a Boulder pilot?
Right.
Well, you know what really intrigued me? The work of Stephen Greer is very interesting to me. I've got a lot of questions on it. What I found was particularly powerful in this interview was the fact that Mr. Daniels, I had at one point attended a Crestone event there given by C. SETI, am I correct? And
right.
He saw, it was remarkable, he reports seeing a UFO craft approach from the distance, beams coming down. That actually is more powerful, a more powerful account than from what I've actually heard from presentations by Greer and his group. So I was amazed by that.
Yeah, one of the, I don't know why necessarily, but CSETI, when you go on a CSETI outing, you are not supposed to talk about what happens there.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Only Stephen Greer can talk about that. And I'm not sure why he does that, because I had talked with other CSETI representatives, and they wouldn't really talk about what their site or anything. So I'm not sure why that is, but certainly Don had a remarkable experience there. And, yeah, I love that interview, because I think about the things he said a lot, especially I love his story about being a commercial pilot and being grounded because he was involved with UFO research, and then he had to take a psychological test so he could say, I'm certifiably sane. You know, that how many people can say that they know they're sane because they've had it checked out and he is certifiably sane. And so they let him fly again, and he said, you know, I'm going to talk about UFOs. It's something I research and am into. And they said, well, just don't do it on company time. And so he took that as, okay, I got the okay, let's talk about UFOs. So that was kind of cool. And just to hear how extraordinary the turnout, I mean, what a big impact that the Disclosure Project had at that to the general public when he did that 2001 press conference with all those credible people, because, you know, they came back and held this event in Boulder, Colorado, and packed house, a ton of people, and that's what inspired me to get into all of this, because when Greer had that, I was a news hound and a journalist, you know, I was going to school as a journalist, and I was, you know, I had asked other journalists, seasoned journalists, well, why don't you talk about UFOs, why don't you cover, oh, are you kidding, if there was some credible evidence, I would cover it, and it would be a big story, which may be the case now, 10 years after Greer's event, but back then, nobody covered it. There was a small story, I think, on CNN, and that was about it. Even though all the major media was at his press conference, they didn't cover it, and all of a sudden, something clicked inside of me and said, that's wrong. I've got to cover this. I got to let people know about this stuff. And
good for you. Mm-hmm.
That was my inspiration, and I've been going ever since.
Well, your research articles and other work, conference organizing, and also being a major presenter at Interface, are just superb. And just for audience as well, and then I'd like you to have just the last 2 minutes to speak, Alejandro. I just, again, wanted to remind our audience that you can read Alejandro Rojas's articles and blogs at the Huffington Post. Also, Alejandro Rojas runs theparanormalreporter.com website, as well as the UFODailyNews.com website. And he tweets at ParanormalRPTR and at UFODailyNews. And Facebook, facebook.com/ParanormalReporter. And Just before, I'd like you to give the final comments here, Alejandro. Any news on Dr. Roger Lear? You've also been a tremendous champion for him, helping people be made aware of his health issues. And, of course, he's done so many wonderful things, including that great press, that great address at the press conference, 2009 X conference.
Yeah, just to say that, you know, it was the Orange County MUFON and the L.A. MUFON that put on these benefits for Roger Lear. It was great of them to do that. They're ran by Jan Harzan and Steve Murillo. So those guys really, hats off to them. And they were able to raise some money. I guess they had some great turnout for those. That's the last I've heard from Steve and Jan there. So that's wonderful that they were able to help out Roger Lear. And if you're not aware, you can go to his website. He has had some health issues recently and did need some financial help, so they did some benefits for him. And Whitley Strieber came out and helped, who's also been an advocate in the for Roger Lear, and he did a talk with Roger Lear along with abduction researcher Yvonne Smith, who's also a wonderful researcher, wonderful person. So they put these together with MUFON to for a benefit for Roger Lear, so that was great. But other than that, really, UFO Daily News is kind of my archive for the UFO stories that I do. I usually will post those on Huffington Post and then archive them onto that site, but add some more pictures and stuff. But also the link, the UFO Daily News feed. The UFO News feed is where you can see all my tweets, because I tweet every day all of the news. So if you want to be up to date on all the UFO news, you can go there. And then the Paranormal Reporter is the same for all the paranormal stuff that's not UFO related. That's kind of my archive of my stories there. And then also the Paranormal Reporter Twitter feed, and which has really grown and got huge. My social networks have gotten really good. So thank you, everybody who's out there who joins those. And it's a lot of fun to have this service, to be able to inform people. And I'm still doing the radio show, which is just a lot of fun for me, and it's gotten a lot of attention. It's one of the top 10 shows usually there on Blog Talk, which has something like 70,000 shows, and so it's doing really well. So thank you so much for all of your kind words, and thank you so much. It's always wonderful to see you at the conferences and to talk to you.
Thank you again, Alejandro. And, you know, I just have to say that this interview was a real learning experience for me. I just really loved absorbing the information and also your responses and your takes on the very important stories coming in now on the in the UFO field. Thank you again, Alejandro. And we thank our audience for their time this evening. And we wish everyone a great weekend. Good night, everyone. Time with us is appreciated. Have a great midsummer weekend.